This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Happy Monday to you, a fine day it is. In the second hour of our program today, we're going to have Ravi Batra, and we're going to be asking the question, particularly given how the stock market has been falling around the world, not quite so bad right now in New York, but 2-3%, some 4% drops in Asia and in Europe overnight, and of course a 300-point drop last Friday in New York. What's up? What should investors do? Where are we going with this economy? Which is falling apart faster, the economy or the environment? Some news on the environment that headlined on Friday, the BBC News report and a worldwide news report, barely mentioned in the United States, and we'll get into that in the second hour of our program. In the third hour of our nation, in our program, Ari Berman is going to be here with the Nation, contributing writer for the Nation, and Arlene Holt Baker of the FL-CIO. So it's going to be an interesting day. The question I'd like to ask in the beginning for this hour, first of all, just even before we get to it, but the question broadly will be: will the right wing continue to dominate America's political debate for another decade? Can we expect that? I mean, is that what we're going to see, the domination by the right?
And to read about. Imagine if you were sitting
a decade. As we get to that, first of all, Ron Paul, there were Republican debates last night. And the thing that I found particularly interesting about this is that all the Republican debates up until last night's, and last night's, by the way, I didn't see. I did... You know, read about it. I read the news reports on it, and we picked up some audio clips from it, but I didn't actually watch the thing live. But the preceding Republican debates, when Ron Paul has talked about getting out of Iraq, ending the war in Iraq is illegal, you need the consent of Congress to declare war, et cetera, et cetera. By and large, those are applause lines for him. Even in Republican circles, pretty much in all of the debates, you know, we've played clips from them before. And so I'm wondering who was in the audience last night. I mean, because Ron Paul, you know, said last night essentially the same thing he's always been saying, and the response from the audience. Now, keep in mind, somewhere between 70% and 80% of Americans want us out of Iraq, you know, as soon as possible. The response from the audience was basically to boo the American people, to say, no, come on, we're the right wing of the Republican Party. We don't want what the rest of America wants. It would be profitable to get out of Iraq after all. You got some defense contractors making a fortune there and buying big ads on TV so that the TV networks won't come after them. And so anyhow, here's Ron Paul.
You're against the Iraq war. So is Senator Clinton. So what are the differences between you?
There's a very big difference. And I think the American people, if we as a party realize this and understand it, 70-some% of the people in America want the war over with. They're sick and tired of it, and they want our troops to come home. Now, Senator Clinton has nothing new to offer. She's endorsing the same policy. She said that the troops would be there for another 5 years, continue to build this embassy that's going to be bigger than the Vatican, continue to build 14 air bases that are going on there, these private bases going on there, and never change.
So, first of all, Ron Paul is joining with all the other Republican candidates and starting in putting out the meme, the assumption Hillary Clinton is going to be the candidate. Why? Well, obviously, because she's the one they want to run against. Second, and you know, that got him a little traction, I suppose. But basically, when he comes out and says, no, we shouldn't be in Iraq, the audience is booing him. This is the GOP debate in Orlando last night. What's that about? You know, if you have some special insight into that, I've not been able to find. I've been poking around, you know, looking at the blogs and reading the, you know, and it's just like, has the tide changed in the Republican Party? Has Ron Paul's message changed somehow? Was this a hand-selected group like the kind that George Bush speaks to? I honestly don't know the answer to the question. I just find the whole situation fascinating. The Republican Party seems to me, in many ways, to be lockstep marching like lemmings off the edge of the cliff. They are in lockstep. People talk about Bush's war. I'm sorry, it's the Republican war. People talk about Bush's suspension of habeas corpus. It's the Republican suspension of habeas corpus. People talk about Bush doing away with the rights to privacy in the United States, Fourth Amendment rights, with illegal wiretapping. I'm sorry, it's the Republican Party's doing away with the Fourth Amendment rights of privacy. And to some extent, the Democratic Party cannot escape culpability in this, because although they have not been advocates, by and large, with a few, a few crazy exceptions of the war and of wiretapping and of the, spying on individual Americans and putting people in prison for years and years and years without even letting them see a lawyer and all that, all these kinds of things, well, they haven't been advocates of it. By and large, they also haven't succeeded in stopping it. And Americans are really upset about this. And ready to hold them to account. And, frankly, for good reason. I think it's about time, frankly. By the way, saw the movie, Louise and I, Friday afternoon, went out and saw the movie Rendition. And I am not a fan of movies that pretend to be drama when, in fact, they are polemics, when, in fact, they're trying to present a political view. And they're few and far between, and they don't generally work. And I say that because this movie is not that. And yet, what was so surprising to me was before we went to see the movie, I went and I read a whole bunch of reviews of it. Roger Ebert gave it 5 stars. That's the maximum. He said, this is just an absolutely brilliant movie, period. And what was interesting were the guys who were giving it 1 and 2 stars or trashing it, who all clearly had some kind of political axe to grind, but it's not a political movie. This is an incredible thriller. It's a brilliant movie. I thought, as a, Louise and I, for 2 days, we were talking about the movie. There are several twists, and I'm not going to give away the movie for you, because you're going to love it. I mean, the Rendition is, as a movie, forget the fact that it has to do with the rendition of people by the CIA, which is a hot-button issue. As a movie, it's a brilliant thriller. It's an absolutely brilliant thriller. So I just want to say, we saw the movie and we were blown away by it. Some brilliant acting. It was just great. Just great. We also saw Run, Baby, Run over the weekend. Ben Affleck's little brother starring. That's another brilliant movie. It was a goof-off weekend. What a nice one, more or less. So back to this issue of, the folks booing Ron Paul, and Ron Paul even getting in on the act and saying Hillary Clinton is the one who's going to win. And, of course, you got Mark Penn, who is this from the Christian Science Monitor, Dave Cook writing about it. Mark Penn is the chief strategist for Hillary Clinton, and he's making the assertion that as many as a quarter of the Republican women will vote for Hillary Clinton simply because she's a woman, that women want to have a woman in the White House. I don't know what he has to back this up. He says, I think you are going to see. That's a little different. He said, I think there is also an emotion. This is being presented in a news story in the Christian Science Monitor. He says, I think there's also an emotional element to have first woman president. One of the poll findings highlighted is that, now here's the fact, 94% of younger women say they are more likely to come out and vote if there's a woman on the ballot for president. So, if all of that is true, and I'm not saying it's not, it may well be, then having Hillary on the ballot would bring out women, particularly single women and young women, who have in droves, tens of millions of them registered but not voting in the last presidential election, bring them into the process, which could make a Democrat president. On the other hand, and this is the thing that astounds me, you get the talking heads and the pundits on TV, and they're constantly talking about Hillary versus Rudy, or Hillary versus unnamed Republican. But they never talk about Republicans versus the specific candidates. And the Global Strategy Group put out a summary. They did a survey on this thing and broke it out. And here's the general election matchups. This is, based on, compiling a bunch of different polls and looking at it. If Rudy Giuliani is running against Clinton, Clinton beats him by 2 points in the polls. If he's running against Edwards, though, Edwards beats him by 4 points. If John McCain is running against Hillary, she beats him by 3 points. If he's running against Edwards, Edwards beats him by 6 points. If Mitt Romney is running against Clinton, she beats him by 10 points. If he's running against Edwards, Edwards beats him by 15 points. If Fred Thompson is running against Clinton, she beats him by 6 points. Edwards beats him by 11 points. So why is the fact that Edwards, nationwide, would beat Republicans more handily than Clinton not being reported? Well, it could have to do with the fact that in the big state, the three largest blue states, there's, you know, just so much publicity about Hillary that it seems impossible to ignore, I guess. I don't know. But it's, I just find this whole process fascinating. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
You're listening to The Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Just a quick summary of, you know, what's going on. Over the weekend, Dick Cheney, as he himself pronounces his own name. He kind of likes the fact that nobody in America even pronounces his name right. This is the guy who deleted his own house from Google Earth. Vice President Dick Cheney yesterday issued his sternest warning to date on Iran. He said, "We will not allow Iran to have a nuclear weapon. The Iranian regime needs to know if it stays on its present course, the international community is prepared to impose serious consequences." The tough guy. This is, you know, Pete Stark last week went off on this short but pithy rant about how they can afford to pay for a war in Iraq. They can't pay for children's health care. And George Bush is perfectly willing to see people blown up, our young men and women blown up for his amusement. And I said on the air, number one, that I agreed with what he said, that I support what he said, and that I figured that in all probability, had he thought it through, he would have replaced at the very end of the sentence "for his own amusement" with "for political gain," because I really believe, and I think probably Pete Stark believes, that that's one of the main reasons why Bush invaded Iraq. Or you could insert, you know, "for oil" or, you know, whatever you want, but I think it was done for political purposes. I think it was done to try and solidify the Republican majority. War presidents have so much power, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And there's been, you know, quite a movement of people coming together and saying, let's support Pete Stark. And I said on Friday that I felt that his saying this on the floor of the House, you know, were I him, I probably wouldn't have said it. And that my guess was that just those last two words, he was probably thinking he shouldn't have said. But I never called for censure of him, and I never called for an apology from him. And the reason why comes back, and in fact, as I said then, and I'm saying now, I support Pete Stark and what he said. And the reason why has to do with the exact same thing that Dick Cheney is doing. He's running around thumping the table. He's playing Khrushchev. And it's chapter 2 in my book, Cracking the Code. Emotion always leads. People anchor memories to emotions. If you want people to remember something, even, you know, no matter what it may be, attach it to an emotion. Back in Massachusetts a couple of decades ago, there was a Republican governor who put into place a program where convicted murderers could get out on furlough. Michael Dukakis came into office as governor and said, this isn't a good program, and eliminated the program. Nonetheless, before he got around to eliminating the program in the third year of his governorship, during the first year of his governorship, Willie Horton got out and went and raped and killed somebody. And so even though it was the preceding governor who was a Republican in Massachusetts who put the program into place and Dukakis ended the program, the Bush campaign, the Bush senior campaign, ran these Willie Horton ads implying, well, not implying. Here's the key. the Willie Horton ads were all about emotion. And the fact of the matter is, actually, that the original ads were not run by the Bush campaign. They were run by a separate group, just like the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, just like the Club for Growth that went after Howard Dean in the Iowa primary, spent $1 million during the Democratic primary to take out one of the Democrats. Why? Because they figured that was the Democrat that could beat a Republican. That Howard Dean was the guy that could easily beat George W. Bush. And they wanted a Democrat who couldn't beat Bush. And so they spent the Club for Growth, this right-wing group, Steve Forbes' group, spent $1 million. Grover Norquist's group spent $1 million on television advertising, the Volvo driving, latte drinking, etc. Howard Dean, taking out Howard Dean in Iowa. The Republicans are all about picking who they're going to run against. This goes all the way back to Nixon deciding that he couldn't win against Ed Muskie, and so he sends Chuck Colson and others up to Maine and or to New Hampshire, and they sabotage the Muskie campaign with lies, and there's even allegations that his coffee had been drugged that morning. Muskie gets up on the back of the flatbed truck and starts crying about his wife because he's been slandered. His wife has been slandered, and you know, he gets tears in his eyes, and the right-wing spin machine goes, because they didn't want to run against Muskie, because they knew that Muskie would easily beat Nixon. They wanted to run against George McGovern, who the polls told them they could beat. And A, I think we're seeing a repeat of the same thing. And B, perhaps the larger point is, emotion always leads. People will make choices based on their emotions before they make choices based on their intellect. This is one of the reasons why this moving away from pain strategy, this use fear as a motivation strategy, which is so incredibly powerful over the short term, but over the long term is actually destructive, that this strategy is the strategy that the Republicans in the White House have been using for 5 years now, and arguably for 25 or 30 years. Although I'd say much of Reagan's strategies, particularly his original strategies, were the moving toward pleasure kind. He borrowed a page from the playbook of John Kennedy. And that's what at least the Republicans remember of him. I mean, a lot of us remember the Reagan recession. We remember Reagan, you know, starting bloody wars in Central America. We remember Reagan, you know, cutting a deal with Iran to keep the hostages. We remember Reagan wiping out the American economy and borrowing us into more debt than we've ever seen in the history of the United States, every other president combined. But nonetheless, he talked a good positive game. But that good negative game that's being talked right now, the emotional game, that's very powerful. And I think Pete Stark hit a powerful emotional note. Dick Cheney trying to do the same. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Past the hour. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. If you'd like to drop into our live chat room, TomHartman.com will get you there. Live chat right up at the top of the page. Our blog on the Tom Hartman page over at AirAmerica.com. And JD it's Chico, California, isn't it? I've been there. Hey, JD, what's up?
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
Can you hear me?
I can. Are we in a Verizon ad?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, great.
I just wanted to say that the thing in Florida, the debate, that's all staged. We know that from the pattern that we are looking at. But something I thought of was, I want to tell you, based on one of your callers last week, getting the fire under me, I've called Chico Peace and Justice to organize a march called MOM, M-O-M, March on Media.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what we need to do.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I just find this amazing that when you match up Edwards against Giuliani, McCain, Romney, or Thompson, any of the four front runners, he absolutely kicks their butts. Clinton barely wins. And Obama, in a couple of cases, Obama substantially beats Mitt Romney. It's Edwards 15 against Romney. Obama 14 against Romney points, Clinton 10 points against Romney. So, you know, according to the polls right now, Romney is the most beatable, and the most beatable by either Edwards or Obama. Although Obama, with Rudy Giuliani, Edwards beats Giuliani by 4 points, Clinton beats him by 2 points, Obama beats him by 1 point. But the one guy who consistently, regardless, when you're looking at the swing states, when you're not looking at New York or California, because the blue states are going to go blue no matter what. New York and California are going to go for the Democrat. It's the swing states you've got to be looking at. When you look at the swing states, you find that Edwards is the guy who consistently is going to beat these people, and Obama has a reasonably good chance. And for Hillary, it's going to be a real challenge. On the other hand, you've got the Hillary camp saying, well, their secret weapon is that you're going to have all these women crossing over, formerly voting for Republicans. They may even be sane because their husbands are Republicans right up until the moment that they walk into the voting booth. Oh, yes, I'm a Republican. My husband's a Republican. We're a Republican family. I'm going to vote. And then they'll vote for Hillary in secret. You never know. You never know. On the other hand, you may have men who are saying, yes, I'm egalitarian. I believe that a woman should have the right to be president. And when they walk into the booth, they'll go, huh, no chance, right? And they'll vote for the man, even if it's Giuliani or something, and they're a Democrat. I mean, who knows ultimately how this is going to shake out? But I find this really interesting about these polls. And what I find even more interesting about the polls is the fact that nobody in the mainstream media is reporting on them. Nobody. JD, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Nice to hear from you. Anthony in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Anthony.
Hey, Tom. I'm calling from the bluest of the blue states, Washington State.
Mm-hmm.
I'd just like to say that, number one, as far as the Pete King thing, Pete Stark.
Right. Yeah, the congressman from California who said Bush was blowing up people for his amusement, if we're talking
about
the same thing.
Right. So basically,
yeah.
I communicated with the Democratic leadership, that would be Pelosi, what's his name in Maryland, Steny Hoyer, and then Rahm Emanuel.
Right.
And I just basically said to all of them, and via their web form on their webpage, that it should be they, the Democratic leadership, that should be admonished. And on that tone, I just want to say that Hillary will be here in Seattle tonight at Benaroya Hall, and we have a lot of progressives that are going to be outside the hall that are just basically going to be chastising those Republican light ideals that she's preaching. And, you know,
well, Anthony, hang on just a second here. At what point do we stop the circular firing squad?
What do you mean?
I mean, you know, a bunch of Democrats standing in a circle saying, you know, ready, aim, fire, and we end up shooting ourselves.
Well, the thing
you really think that Rudy Giuliani would be a better president than Hillary Clinton?
Well, the thing is we're starting these primaries or whatever, the whole process, way too early, first of all.
I agree.
So, you know, when you talk about the big media proclaiming her as the front runner, I have never talked to anybody, especially in this state, the bluest of the blue states,
right,
that, you know, supports Hillary. So the people that are coming out to support Hillary tonight, you know,
I've talked to a number of people of goodwill who I respect who support Hillary Clinton. And as I've said on this program, if she's the nominee of the party, I will support her.
Yes, if she is the nominee.
Here's my question, Anthony. Instead of standing outside saying no to Hillary or we don't like Hillary or, you know, Hillary's bad on fill in the blank, why not stand outside with a sign that says, I support Barack Obama, I support John Edwards, I support Dennis Kucinich, I support Chris Dodd, something like that? Why not make a positive statement? Or Senator Clinton, please vote in favor of? Or, you know, why not make positive statements rather than negative statements?
It's like talking to a brick wall. You know, like when I talked about earlier, when I sent the email out to Rahm Emanuel, Steny Hoyer, and all the like, it's like, why did they chastise, you know, that representative for actually saying the truth for once? You know, it's like the Democratic leadership, of which Hillary is the part, you know, it's just like
I don't recall Hillary Clinton chastising Pete Stark. I mean, maybe it happened and I didn't notice it, but I agree with you that
I quoted it. It's on the if you just log in, Pelosi admonish Stark.
I agree with you about the Democratic leadership. They have been increasingly spineless. They are terrified. Somebody needs to whack them upside the head and say, hey, quit being timid. Quit being afraid. You got nothing to fear but fear itself. Listen to it, you know.
Then why can't we stand outside and protest Hillary, the poster child for the spineless people?
Well, you certainly can. But modestly suggesting, and I'm not opposed to your being out there and protesting. In fact, you know, our conversation here is giving it an enormous amount of publicity. And I would love to see, if I was an organizer, if I was participating in this, the question I would be asking myself is, how can we put forward the most positive message possible? So when the media picks this up, they get it that we are in favor, actually, of a national single-payer health care system. We are in favor of rolling back the Reagan tax cuts. We are in favor of a national defense policy that is the model of the world.
My sign says, progressives reject Hillary. I think that's kind of clear.
Yeah, but it's also a negative statement.
I totally agree with everything that you say generally, but I just think on this one point, I don't like her coming to Seattle to try to squeeze money out of us, you know, when we don't support her.
You know, she's not squeezing. She's coming to raise, you know, funds from people who want to be there and want to be with her. I mean, I find myself in an awkward position here of supporting a candidate who's not the candidate of my choice. But nonetheless, I mean, Anthony, I'm not criticizing you. I'm really not criticizing you. And your sign is fine. I just would like you to ask yourself if or when the Channel 6 or whatever it is there in Seattle news camera shows up and takes a shot of you and your poster. What is the message that could be on that poster that would have the greatest possibility of positively impacting the Democratic primary? And it may well be progressives oppose Hillary, but it might be something else. And I would just, you know, progressives would like a more aggressive, a real national health care program, or progressives would like to do away with, trade deals, no more phony trade deals or something like that. I mean, take on the policy rather than the person.
Can I just ask this one thing then?
Sure.
Why is it, you know, and the media is saying this, big media, that the candidates are now attacking one another, you know, as we get further along in this process. So why is it?
Yeah, very tentatively.
I'm sorry?
Very tentatively they are, yes.
But it's like, why is it that we, the voters, the people they're trying to appeal to, why can't we attack the candidates who we don't like?
Well, again, I'm not saying you shouldn't. I think three or four times here I've said, you know, that good on you for getting out there, good on you for holding up a sign, and maybe that sign is the best sign. Maybe there would be a more effective sign. I'm not positioning myself as the absolute expert on this, and it just seems to me that if we want to ignite the imagination of particularly swing voters and the average Americans, rather than saying, no, we don't like Hillary either, that's a message that, you know, is going to echo down for a while. It would be better to take on the specific policies and try and push her in a direction, much like FDR was pushed after he was elected in 32.
Push her support for the war? Then?
Yeah, for example, you know, progressives against the war. Progressives in favor of pulling out tomorrow.
Iran thing?
Yeah, progressives in favor of out of Iraq now. I mean, you know, or even a sign that says out of Iraq now. I mean, deal with the issues rather than attacking the individual. I just think that will have more success, over the long term, both over the short term and the long term. Again, I might be wrong, but I would love for you to have a conversation with your fellow activists and you know, call the show and let us know what happened. And also,
okay,
be curious to find out what happens tonight when you show up, regardless of what your sign says. You know, give us a call tomorrow
right.
And let us know. Okay? But I salute you, sir. I think it's marvelous that you're out there. I think it's marvelous that you're showing up and that you have the passion to do that. And we need a hell of a lot more of us out there doing that, whatever it
you're
may
right.
be. Whatever
you're absolutely
our signs
right.
Say.
I find that I'm 38 years old. I find that I'm the youngest person that's out there. I don't know where the youth of today is. It's like, are they just totally
brain dead?
They're
scared to
what?
Death that they're not going to have enough money to pay off their college loans or their credit cards is the bottom line. You know, the 26 years of Republican conservative economic policies have wiped them out, and they're frightened. In my opinion. Anthony, thanks a lot for the call. Good luck. 45 minutes left.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
My point is that we need to be focusing on the emotion, because emotion is the power that carries a message and what people remember, and tie that emotion to the issues. Here is a classic example of a guy running for president following a guy from another party. Well, I'll just lay it out. This is Richard Nixon running for president after Lyndon Johnson got us going in Vietnam. And he's running against the Vietnam War, and he's running against the damage that the Vietnam War has done to us around the world.
For 4 years, this administration has had the support of the loyal opposition for the objective of seeking an honorable end to the struggle. Never has so much military and economic and diplomatic power been used so ineffectively. And if after all of this time and all of this sacrifice and all of this support, there is still no end in sight, then I say the time has come for the American people to turn to new leadership, not tied to the mistakes and the policies of the past. That is what we offer to America.
So there you go. That's, you know, from Richard Nixon. Right. A lesson in politics. 1-866-303-2270. John in L.A. Hey, John.
Yes, good morning, Tom.
You are on the air. What's up?
Okay. Listen, I wanted to say something about the Republican debate last night. It was very perceptive of you to conclude that there was something up with that audience booing Ron Paul in view of the fact that you didn't actually see the debate. I did, and there were two things that were just amazing. One is that after the debate, there was a phone-in, not census, what do you call it? Poll.
Straw poll, yeah.
Poll, and Ron Paul won easily. He had 34% to Huckabee, who was second, who had 27, I believe, and third was... the big good-looking.
Yeah. See, the Republicans are having the same problem or the same experience, I guess, as the Democrats right now, and that is that when you're talking to the base, when you're talking to the people who are actively involved and are most likely to vote in the primaries, then you find that, you know, on the Republican side, they seem most engaged by either the libertarian Ron Paul or by the former Baptist preacher Mike Huckabee, and
right.
and to some extent a few of the others. But that's really where their passion is, because these guys are speaking for them. And on the Democratic side, when you talk to the people who are the most likely primary voters, you find that they're really excited about John Edwards, they're really excited about Dennis Kucinich, they like Chris Dodd, they like Barack Obama. And yet, those are not the names that you hear in the press 30, 40, 50 times a day. What you hear in the press 30, 40, 50 times a day are Rudy Giuliani and Hillary Clinton, as if it's a fiat accompli. And it's because, in my opinion, those are the candidates that the corporate mainstream media want to be running for president. Our candidates are being chosen for us by the big media machines, in my opinion.
Yeah, well, I agree with you, but I think it may be a little bit more sinister than that. I think that they really did choose that audience based on a dislike for Ron Paul. After the debate, they did a Hannity and Combs thing, and Hannity is very strongly opposed to Ron Paul, of course, because he's in favor of the war. And they interviewed some of the people that were in the debate, including Ron Paul. And I've never seen anything like it. When Ron indicated that he had won the phone-in poll easily, Hannity came up with this unbelievably red face and just was at a loss for words. It was.
Well, same thing happened last time. The last time Fox News sponsored a poll, I actually watched that, or a Republican debate. I watched that one. It was a month or so ago. Afterwards.
And there was
Ron Paul had it like 54% of it or something last time. I mean, it's huge.
Yeah, but there was one other thing that was very interesting. That guy, Luntz, you know, that fat pollster, I forget his
Frank
first
Luntz,
name.
Yeah, he's the
Spurmeister. He did a focus group thing before the debate started. And it was very interesting. And after the debate, they went back to them. And that group also, there was not one person that was favorably impressed by Ron Paul's performance. So I'm pretty sure that group was also selected based on their dislike for Ron Paul. That
well, this
thing is
This is what the Republicans do. They decide who the Democratic nominee is going to be, and within their own party, they decide who the Republican nominee is going to be. And then they put the veneer, the patina of democracy on the top of it, which, by the way, goes all the way back to John Adams. You know, late 1790s, John Adams suggesting that we shouldn't have democracy. We should have something that looks like democracy. And so, anyhow, we'll see. Maurice in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Maurice.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Fine. But I'll get better. What's up?
Well, I want to make three statements. Two of them sound contradictory. Excuse me. First and foremost, you asked the question, did you think that the Republicans will continue their dominance into the next decade, if I'm not mistaken? Personally, I don't think that's necessarily the case because of the fact that they've used race and racism to the extent that it has made people vote against their own interests, and now this country has become more acclimated to the fact that none of us are going anywhere. Some people may not accept it, but I think in the back of their minds they know that.
In other words, people are figuring out their game.
Yeah, well, not necessarily. It's just even the most ardent racists know that I, as a black person, or Jews or Catholics, they're not going anywhere, so you just have to get used to that.
Yeah. And you guys aren't the real threat, and I'm not the real threat. The real threat is the conservative economic policies that are destroying America.
Indeed. Well, secondly, Hillary Clinton, I'm actually supporting other people, and I will only support her if she gets the Democratic nomination. However, I think it's sinister because I feel as though the multinational corporations, as you just stated, they want to create the illusion of democracy. So ultimately, they want to make people believe that, oh, a Democrat will change things, but this particular Democrat will only move us a little further to the left, just as her husband did, whom I've often said was the worst thing that ever happened to a Democratic Party, but I digress.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I got your point, Maurice. And yeah, Bill Clinton was more concerned, you know, Dwight Eisenhower was more liberal than Bill Clinton. Let's just leave it at that. 57 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, Viagra for your brain. This is Air America Radio.
Well, the economic turmoil of the planet seems to be spreading. 26 years of Reaganomics, neoliberalism, crazy conservative economic, whatever you want to call it, is taking its toll. Free trade mania. The international market's down substantially overnight. The U.S. market right now is above zero. I think the Dow is up about 30 points. But gold has been climbing, oil hitting all-time highs. What's going on, and how should people protect themselves? How should they invest? What should we be doing about it? What at core is going on here? So a couple of fascinating articles in today's Financial Times that raise a number of troubling questions. And so with us is Ravi Batra, our favorite economist of the show. He's a professor of economics at Southern Methodist University, Dallas, the author of five international bestsellers, his latest books, The New Golden Age and Greenspan's Fraud. Dr. Ravi Batra, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
It's always great to have you with us.
Thank you.
Let's start out here. This from the Financial Times today, Ben White in New York reporting. The headline, U.S. defaults hit cars and cards. Credit problems once confined to high-risk mortgage borrowers are spreading across the consumer landscape. U.S. banks have raised reserves up to $6 billion, indicating financial executives believe consumers will be increasingly unlikely to make payments on a variety of loans. These include car loans, home equity loans, and credit cards. It looks like the banking industry is hunkering down. They're getting ready for a firestorm.
Well, Tom, I think on your show last time I said that this book, The New Golden Age, The New Golden Age came out sometime in February, and I had written in the book that a housing mortgage crisis would start in the middle of the year, and then the Fed would react to it, cut interest rates, but it would just be a band-aid to the crisis, and the crisis would keep spreading until there is total economic chaos, and then there is a revolution. But after the revolution comes the new golden age. That was the message of this book, and that's exactly what's happening right in front of us. the Fed did react very strongly to the crisis, I think, last month, and then they cut the interest rate sharply by half a point, and then the markets immediately reacted positively, as if the everything was hunky dory. But there are really fundamental problems in the economy, which I have described in my latest books, and because of those fundamental problems, until they raise wages in the United States. That's the whole thing.
Until they raise wages.
Wages. And I don't see anybody scrambling to raise wages in America.
Right.
Unless they raise wages in the United States, unless they follow policies that will raise wages to the level of rising productivity, we are going to have these problems. And I don't think I don't see that happening unless there is a revolution, and therefore I'm predicting a revolution is coming soon.
Define revolution.
Right now, everything is in the hands of the wealthy, the culture, the economy, the politics. So I'm predicting that the rule of money will be overthrown in the economy. People would become so poor, the unemployment would rise so strongly, and then the rest of the world would also take out their assets from the United States. Things will become so bad that people would revolt and overthrow the real culprit. The real culprit is the rule of money. Money in the economy, that will be overthrown. And that, to me, is the revolution.
You're talking about a situation like we've seen in several South American countries, where it's a revolution by the ballot box, ultimately, but a fundamental rethinking of the role of government.
That's right. People become fed up in the end. They say, we need to try something new.
Or it's what we saw here in 32.
That's right. What do you mean, in 1932?
Yeah, 1932.
Yeah, right, exactly, yeah. Yeah.
Now, so how much worse do you expect it's going to get? And what, every time I have you on, I get a lot of email, and one of the most common questions that people ask is, I've got $150,000 in my 401k, or I've got $300,000 in my 401k, or frankly, more often, I've got $26,300 in my 401k. What should I do with it? How do I invest, I've got a house that's worth $200,000 with a $180,000 mortgage. Should I borrow the other $20,000 and totally max out, or should I pay it down as much as I can in cash in my 401k to take my mortgage down to $100,000? These kinds of questions. How should people be positioning themselves for what's coming, in your opinion?
Before I answer this question, I want to make an announcement. The reason I want to make an announcement is because some of the people who have been sending you emails have sent me emails also.
Mm-hmm. I'm not surprised.
Yeah, and of course they are asking, how should I protect myself and so on. But they are also asking, what could we do to keep this period of chaos and uncertainty and joblessness short? What should our role be in the economy and the country's politics? And what I have been doing, and I've suggested to people, is also this. I have written these books to educate the public to see what's really going on. What is creating the problem? It is unethical economics, unethical policies, starting with the Reagan administration, have been creating these problems. And until those policies are gone, nothing can be done. But who will throw those policies out? People have to really take action themselves. So here's an announcement I'm going to make. I am trying to make a documentary called Greenspan's Fraud. I've written a book. Remember, we have written a book. Now
one of my all-time favorite books.
Thanks a lot. So I'm now trying to make a documentary called Greenspan's Fraud. Greenspan's book is number one or two on the bestseller list right now. And I'm thinking that if I could present a strong contrast to what he has done and what his kind of thinking has done to our economy, then maybe then it will wake up the public, and they will take action so that this period of chaos that I'm predicting is coming.
Do you know Robert Greenwald?
Pardon?
Do you know Robert Greenwald? He's made a number of movies about the various frauds and follies of this administration. I'm in at least one or two of them. And drop me an email when we get off the air. I'd be glad to connect you two guys.
Oh, that'll be great.
I need
commentators who can comment on what Greenspan policies have meant to them. I also need some investors to bring this idea to fruition so that we can wake up the public and say, look, this, right now everything is okay, but things are gradually, slowly deteriorating, and then a time will come next year and the year after will be horrible, and we better do something right
now. And if it happens the year after, of course, the Democrats will get blamed for it. We're talking with Ravi Batra, professor of economics at Southern Methodist University. His latest book's The New Golden Age and Greenspan's Fraud. His website, Ravi Batra, RAVIBATRA.com. So back to the question, Ravi, how should people, you know, at the micro level, at the personal level, what do we do to protect ourselves?
Well, there are a number of things we can do. If suppose we bought a house, say, two, three years ago, paid a lot of money, and the house prices are falling, and they're going to fall drastically, much more in the near future, in a year or two. Remember last time I talked about this cycle of inflation. And the cycle of inflation says that every three decades, there is very high commodity inflation. And this commodity inflation is reflected partly in this big rise in the price of oil. And last time we talked, oil was at around 75-something. Now it's around close to 90. And so this oil price will keep rising. That means the economy is going to deteriorate fast. Housing prices are going to fall very fast starting next year and the year after. So if you have a big mortgage, I would unload it now, especially if it's crimping your living standard.
You mean sell the house and rent?
Yeah, that's right. That's one thing I would do.
Get out of debt.
Especially if your mortgage is very high and you're crimping your lifestyle, I would sell. If your mortgage is reasonable, that's a different matter altogether, because it's very hard for people to even contemplate selling the house. So I don't normally suggest that. But if the mortgage is really very high, then I would sell it. And then the other thing is, gold is going to rise. Mm-hmm. Gold is good to put money in.
So you think that's a reasonable investment?
That's a reasonable investment.
Buying gold stocks or exchange-traded funds?
I would buy gold bullion, gold coins. I don't trust the stock market, because the stock market is manipulated like mad. And so these stocks can have scandals of their own.
Mm-hmm. And then, so bullion coins?
Gold coins will be fine.
Canadian maple leaves, U.S. Right. dollars. Yeah, that
kind exactly. Of,
interesting. Yeah. Ravi Batra, ravibatra.com, the website, his books, The New Golden Age and Greenspan's Fraud. Ravi, always great talking with you.
Thanks. So can we talk about Greenwald then? How do I talk to you about him?
Send me an email. We'll be in touch with you on back channel. Don't worry about it. We will get in touch with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Strange stuff, strange goings on. I have to tell you a couple more things that I'm noticing that I see as fault lines here, and things that we really should be paying attention to. But first, just a little odd story for the day, just a little crazy. You know anybody who's had sudden hearing loss? Maybe some famous talk show host? I don't know. The FDA has just decided that they're now labeling the entire class of what are called PDE5 medications. These are the drugs that include Viagra. They're putting a new label on them. These things may cause sudden hearing loss. Oh. Anyhow, this story from the Financial Times today about the U.S. default hitting cars and cards. This is the point that Ravi Batra makes that I've been making on this program for 5 years now. We will be, in fact, this in February or March, we'll be starting the sixth year of this program. Problems can be seen at banks across the U.S. Anyhow, the point that I've been making all these years is that an economy is driven by demand. You put money in people's pockets, they buy things. That's called demand. They buy things, they want things, and so then entrepreneurs, business people, or existing businesses say, hey, there's a demand for this. Let's make it. That's how it has worked for 7,000 1,000 years. And then Reagan came along with this crazy idea of supply-side economics of let's figure out, and really it was just an economic justification to restore the political and economic power to the top 1/100th of 1% that had been taken away from them by Franklin Roosevelt when he raised the income tax rate up to 91% on every dollar earned after $3.2 million in today's dollars, which had a tremendous leveling effect on America. And we didn't have an explosion of billionaires in the landed gentry, and we did have an explosion of the middle class, and executives still work just as hard as they work today. And companies were just as successful, in fact, arguably more successful. The rate of economic growth from 1940 to 1980 was greater, almost twice as great as the rate of economic growth from the time Reagan began rolling back the New Deal, these new policies, until today. And wages certainly were climbing steadily from 1940 to 1980. And from 1981, when Reagan came into office, until today, wages have been steadily declining. So what drives the economy is demand. And up until about 10, 12 years ago, that demand came from, as Reaganomics was starting to really creep in and whack the middle class, that demand was coming from people getting decent paychecks. And, you know, between Reagan and Bush Sr. and Clinton and Bush Jr., outsourcing our jobs, providing tax incentives to corporations, transnational corporations to move over operations overseas, move their labor force overseas, or use an overseas labor force, and on and on. I mean, basically hollowing out the interior of America's industrial core. You know, it's amazing. I heard this riff on public radio about how, oh, you know, we've got more trade. The United States has more trade than any other country in the world. Well, yeah. But see, it's what kind of trade? When Reagan came into office, and for the 200 years prior to that, the United States was the largest, and for the 200 years preceding that, one of the largest. But when Reagan came into office, we were the largest importer of raw materials and exporter of finished goods. We brought in the ore, and we shipped out the cars. We shipped out the television sets. We shipped out the radios. We shipped out the appliances. We shipped, you know, computers right across the board. We made it here in the U.S. You'll recall Sam Walton, those of you old enough to remember, the whole Walmart motto was "Made in the USA." Big signs all over the store. Because we made everything in the USA. And now after Reagan, Bush, Clinton, Bush, we make very little in the United States anymore. So anyhow, the point is that we used to drive demand by having people having decent wages. And they would use that money to say, you know, okay, I'm a consumer. I'm going to go out in the marketplace and buy something. Who's got something to offer? You know, here's what I want. And people would say, oh, you know, there's a market opportunity here. I think people are looking for this particular product, so I think I'm going to start making that. And then as an excuse to do away with the New Deal, which built the American middle class, Reagan said, no. The way we should do it is we should give all the money, that is, cut the top tax rate from 91% down to 27%, and give all that money to people making millions or billions, more than $3.2 million a year, the millionaires and the billionaires, give that money to them, and they will build factories and produce goods, and that supply of goods will cause American consumers to say, wow, look at all that cool stuff, I want to buy some of it. It's called supply-side economy. It doesn't work. It's insane. People don't buy things because they're there. I mean, arguably, with a good enough ad campaign, you can sell some things. But by and large, people buy things because they want them. Or more importantly, because they need them. So this was just the covering on it. And now we see U.S. defaults hit cars and cards. It's not just home loans. It's credit cards and car loans that are starting to default at rapid rates, which is showing us that the only demand that has been driving the economy, basically since Reagan, largely over the last 10, 15 years, is demand based on debt. And that's unsustainable.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Freedom's all our own, and I know it's out there. And now
Still
my home.
Stephen writes in, he says, hey, Tom, regarding the caller attacking Hillary versus attacking policies, he says, I think you're right. Here's an answer. Here's an idea. The guy should go to the Hillary rally with a big sign that says, we love Hillary, but we don't support the war. He says, or similar. That way the vibe would be good about the person, but clear about the policy. Also, if Hillary saw a lot of these signs at rallies, she might start rethinking the policy, and Republicans would have nothing to slime with. Same with Obama. We love Obama. No war on Iran. Stuff like that. Well, that's an interesting one. Although, you know, I think that there's something to be said for absolute integrity in your message. One other interesting piece here from today's Financial Times. Tony Jackson writes a column. This is called Tony Jackson on Monday. And he says, in today's troubled credit market, there is apparently one oasis of calm. Infrastructure funds report business as usual. Now, what the heck is an infrastructure fund? These are private funds that buy airports and roads. In other words, they're buying the commons. He says, if that sounds ideal, there is a hitch. There are too few things to buy. These funds are, in essence, recycling past privatizations. Not enough new ones are coming along. So get with the program, countries. Start selling yourself off to the multinationals. The transnational corporations want to buy more of America, more of Japan, more of Germany, more of England, more of France. They want to buy our water systems. They want to buy our roads. They want to buy our stop signs. Put up toll roads, put up flags. They want to make money on the stuff that we used to think we owned. Our national parks, our assets. He's talking about a conference in London, the Terrapin Conference. He says, speaker after speaker urged delegates to press the case for privatization around the world. None of this challenges the view that infrastructure is now established as an asset class, nor that it will keep growing. What does this thing? You get it? I mean, this, it's like, forget national sovereignty. Forget, oh, it's our country. Forget all these quaint notions of independence and democracy and self-rule. Just turn it over to the multinational corporations. They'll take care of it. And when you call and try and complain about the service, their person in India who answers the phone will laugh at you and hang up. Isn't that how it's supposed to be? By the way, this is Fascism Awareness Week. I've renamed it. I'm not even going to name the guy who's out there with his other kind of fascism awareness. I'm not even going to go there this week. Instead, I'm going to suggest that this be Fascism Awareness Week, and that what we should all be doing is we should be encouraging our friends to read The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich by William Scherer, It Can't Happen Here by Milton Mayer, and We the People by Tom Hartman, which has a couple of chapters in it about the rise of fascism in the United States. It's also a real easy read because it's an illustrated book. And even though it's a 100-and-some-plus page kind of comic book, illustrated book, it's frankly, I think it's one of the very best books I've written. And Screwed also deals with this topic. And there's other good books out there. Naomi Wolf's new book about the decline of America. There's a number of excellent books about the rise of fascism in the United States and around the world. Let's make it Fascism Awareness Week, all of us, and let's start waking people up to it. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Barbara in Murfreesboro, Illinois, listening on WINI, one of our very first affiliates way back five years ago. Hey, Barbara, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just want to say that our family are fans of yours.
Well, thank you.
And we saw you at the Green Festival. We were visiting our daughter in Washington, and we were at the Green Festival, and it was a lot of fun. We learned a lot.
Well, thank you.
But I wanted to touch on a point you made a little while ago, and you kind of further discussed it in the last few minutes while I was waiting. Talking about the foreign companies that have come here and, you know, basically bought up America and are using what we felt we owned, like our minerals and our lumber. I remember reading this in articles in the past, but the thing that I remember reading about also was the fact that the United States did this to other countries.
Yes. Yeah. This is nothing new.
Our companies have done this.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. Economic colonialism, it's called, or just plain old colonialism, but largely economic colonialism. And certainly we practiced it. I mean, it's how we ended up with Hawaii, is we had a pineapple company there. We were doing the same thing down in Nicaragua. It's one of the reasons that we intervened in Iran, because the democratically elected government of Iran in 1953, I think it was Mossadegh, said, you know, we're going to nationalize the oil. It's our oil. And we had a bunch of U.S. oil companies in there. And we said, oh, no, you're not. And we took him out. We put in the Shah of Iran. And that led directly to the Iranian situation that we have today. Same thing in Iraq, for that matter.
Right. And so, you know, what's the answer? I feel like this is karma coming back on us in a way, because now, you know, look at what's happening in our country. We're having all this foreign, we're being bought up. And really, you know, could the answer be that nations really should be making things more locally and using them more locally?
Adam Smith's argument in favor of trade between nations in his book Wealth of Nations, his 1776 book, was that when there are things that other countries make exclusively that you cannot make because you don't have the land to grow to make that kind of cheese or that kind of wine or whatever, when there are things that other countries make and that you can't make, it makes absolute perfect sense to trade with them and sell them things that you uniquely can make that they can't make. That is the ideal of free trade. That we should be importing the things that we have no interest in making in this country, no desire to make in this country, don't have the ability to make in this country, not because we're lacking the technology or whatever, but because, you know, we don't grow sandalwood, so we're not going to have carved sandalwood statues in the United States. That's something that, of course, you're going to import. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to things that are essential to your economy, you know, whether in the case of Adam Smith's day it was, you know, nails for horseshoes or horseshoes themselves or you know, something like that. When it comes to those kind of things, you don't trade those things. You protect your domestic industries in those things so that you have strong domestic industries. That's a desirable thing. But you're absolutely right. I mean, since Reagan came into office, we have sold 14,833 companies worth $1,880,000,000,000 to foreign companies. Our sound recording industries in the United States, and you can see all this over at economyandcrisis.org, our sound recording industries are 97% foreign owned. Our commodity contracts dealing industries are 79% foreign owned. Our motion picture and sound recording industries, 75% foreign owned. All of the metal ore mines in the United States, all of our metal assets, 65% foreign owned.
What I was thinking, yeah.
Yeah, our book publishers, 63% foreign owned. I mean, three of my books have been published by Random House, which is the largest publisher in the United States. They're owned by Bertelsmann in Germany. I mean, it's a foreign owned company.
And so basically, what other countries did about this was to say no.
That's right.
And, you know, basically tried to throw the foreigners out, you might say, or like the companies. Isn't that what Hugo Chavez is doing?
Yes, and not just Chavez. I mean, that's what China does, that's what Japan does, that's what South Korea does. People that we wouldn't think of as you know, left-wing, you know, crazies as the right likes to try to portray Chavez.
Right.
And it's what we did in this country for 200 years, is we protected our domestic economy. And now you've got Republicans out there and conservative Democrats saying, oh, this is wonderful, it's called insourcing. So you have Toyota making plants here in the United States. Isn't that great? They're employing people. Well, you know, I've got no beef with Toyota. And you know, no problem with them. In fact, I drive a Prius. But the fact of the matter is that when a product is manufactured in the United States by a foreign-owned company, the only reason that a company exists is to make a profit. And that profit is going outside the United States. And so, you know, how is that a good thing? It's not. But it's a situation that has to exist because our trade policies are so crazy that we've shifted all these dollars offshore out of the United States, and those people have to spend them someplace. And what's the country that takes dollars? Us. So, Barbara, right. I've got to move along, but thank you for calling.
I
appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Bill in Elizabeth, New Jersey. Hey, Bill, what's up? Bill? No Bill. Okay, John in Los Angeles, California. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Hey, I think gold is one of the more socially irresponsible places to put your wealth, if you will, whether it's monetary wealth or just your sweat wealth.
Because the mining of gold is environmentally rough?
No, because gold doesn't contribute as much to society as, let's say, the infrastructure. Mm. It's better societally than for society than the military is an investment because that just blows things up.
Right, but you and I can't invest in a bridge.
Yes, we can. We can.
By buying local bonds, you mean?
If we take our government back and get the government to build infrastructure instead of build bonds. Okay.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. And you can buy local bonds. In fact, most local bonds are totally tax-free. Many are, anyway. But the problem is you have a 2.5-3% return on investment.
Mm-hmm.
One
of the things that your last guest had mentioned was about gold, but he was also talking about after a revolution, people will be thinking differently, and gold is the old way of thinking. We shouldn't depend upon some golden calf or a golden tank to protect us and make us better.
Got your point, John. Got your point. And well said. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
And welcome back. 9 minutes before the hour, 9.5 minutes. Tom Hartman here with you. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
I am just great. How about you?
I'm very well indeed.
And in Washington, D.C., what's going on?
Well, in Washington, D.C., President Bush's approval rating is now 25%.
Oh, he's gone up a point.
Well, it's record low approval according to an American Research Group survey. So it depends who you look at, but it's pretty appalling, basically.
Yeah. Any idea what Nixon was at his valley?
I'm not sure that he got as low as this.
Really?
Well, I mean, if he did, it was rare. I didn't think that he got into the mid or low 20s myself. But
yeah,
I could be wrong.
If this is a record low for all presidents or for just Bush.
This is a record low for Bush, but I don't know that anybody ever got lower than Nixon, did they?
I don't remember, frankly.
I don't.
I know he was in the 20s, but I don't.
Yeah,
I don't know where.
It's pretty dreadful. Meantime, he's about to request an additional $46 billion for the wars. He'll be asking that a little bit later on this week, according to the Associated Press. That'll bring the total to $196.4 billion. So give or take a few billion, we're up to $200 billion now.
So, he, at the very least. You mean for this year?
For the total. That's the total for, let's see, let me get this right. The figure which Bush was expected to announce later Monday at the White House brings to $196.4 billion the total requested for operations in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere for budget year that started October the 1st, correct?
Right. Yeah, for this year.
For this year.
Because we're looking at a $1 trillion total when you project out the next couple of years. I mean, it's mind-boggling. So here, let's just put this in perspective. About 30% of Americans believe that there is evidence that UFOs have landed and that the U.S. government has had contact with them.
Yeah, including me, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I wonder what percentage of Americans think pigeons are robots from the planet Xenu. about 30% of Americans believe that Saddam Hussein was behind 9/11.
Right.
So we have basically just a little less than a third of Americans who, for whatever reason, you know, because they're working five jobs, because they're not paying attention, because they can't afford to have, you know, to have a TV and pay attention to the media, because they don't care about politics, they just want to know who won the big game last night. Fill in the blank. I mean, who knows the reasons? We have about a third of Americans who are politically and factually mind-bogglingly ignorant. You know, who it's the, you know, it's the Canada, the Canadian show. This hour has 60 minutes. They have this feature. We used to see it in Vermont because we get Canadian TV up there. And every week they'd come down and they'd ask Americans rational questions and get irrational answers. You know, like, please congratulate Canada. We just finished our first paved road all the way across the state of Alberta. And people are going, congratulations, Canada, on your first paved road. You know, or, they actually went to one of the major universities and got people to sign a petition to stop the practice of putting elderly people on ice floes and sending them out into Lake Michigan or Lake Ontario, rather. And, of course, there's no ice. I mean, it's just, in any case, it's just they like to make 25. So here we have 30% of Americans, roughly 25-30%, who are just, I mean, we shouldn't even be considering these people's opinions in these polls. And that's where Bush's approval rating is at. Given that, why are the Democrats in Congress afraid of him?
I don't know. I think that they are not so much afraid of him. I think that they have a mindset that there are voters out there who not only support him, but have a mindset that goes beyond him, that will somehow lockstep support the so-called war on terrorism. And so that they are afraid that if they go up against warrantless wiretapping or any of these so-called national security issues, they will automatically come up against these voters.
We so need to be telling our elected officials not to be terrified. It's time not to be afraid. You know, it's just time not to be afraid. What else is going on in Washington, D.C.?
Well, as you know, Vice President Cheney has said that absolutely Iran must not get a nuclear weapon, and that we must do whatever it takes to make sure that they must not. Obviously, he intends to go to war. In the debate last night, Giuliani echoed that and said that it would be worse for Iran to have a nuclear weapon than it would be to go to war with them. He actually said that.
You're kidding.
No, he actually said that.
I wonder if he thinks the same thing is true of Pakistan or North Korea.
He wasn't asked about that, but you've got to start wondering, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, is this one unique country that there's no problem going to war with, but the other countries that have nuclear weapons we're not going to go to war with? That's mind-boggling.
It is quite mind-boggling. What is going on is really quite extraordinary. As you also know, that Representative Henry Waxman is now accusing Blackwater of tax evasion.
Yes, by saying that their employees were actually independent contractors and therefore they didn't have to deduct Social Security and pay unemployment taxes and things.
Right. Of course, one's mind goes back to Al Capone and you wonder whether this may be an area in which they're maybe going to be got.
Yeah, that's true. That is, Al Capone did go to prison for tax evasion and not much else.
Because nobody's going to get them for anything else.
Yeah.
Those are really the major issues. Everybody in Washington, of course, is talking about the Republican debate and the fact that Fred Thompson seemed to finally wake up and that John McCain showed some spark. But that despite that, it seems that the race is Giuliani's to lose.
Except that when the Fox did their straw poll afterwards, guess who won? Ron Paul.
And he shows signs always, even with the values voters over the weekend. He came out surprisingly strongly with the values voters, despite the fact that he's against the Iraq war.
And he's raised more money than John McCain.
Yeah.
I think that there is a small segment of people, even in the Republican Party, and this is why I believe in redemption. I think that even Republicans can be redeemed. There's a small segment in the Republican Party who honor truth tellers. And Ron Paul, even though I disagree with 95% of his politics and policies, tells the truth. You know, he just absolutely tells the truth.
He tells it like he sees it. He doesn't sugarcoat it or pander.
Yeah. Thank you, Victoria. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, TalkRadioNews.com. Coming up next, Rudy's Dirty Money. Stick around. 57 minutes past the hour.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Welcome to the Democracy Zone.
Well, New York Mayor Ed Koch, in a more innocent time, shall we say, perhaps in a less cynical time, perhaps in a more American time, said, you can get rich or you can get elected. The implication, of course, being you can't do both. Rudy Giuliani decided not to take Mr. Koch's advice. Ari Berman is with us. He's a writer with The Nation, thenation.com, contributing writer for The Nation, contributor to The Notion, and a Puffin Foundation writing fellow at The Nation Institute. Ari, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you here with us. You have a new article in The Nation called Rudy's Dirty Money. This is absolutely mind-boggling. Unless there's someplace else you'd like to start out, I'm curious about Bracewell and Patterson. I'd like you to start with Bracewell and Patterson and tell us about this organization.
Sure. Well, the story is about how Rudy, maybe that should be a new nickname for him, I don't know, hooked up with this law firm called Bracewell and Patterson, which was known basically as the most aggressive wing of the energy industry inside Washington. So basically, when the energy industry, different sectors of it wanted to kill legislation, they would go to Bracewell, and Bracewell would get all these lobbyists together to basically enact these sort of policies. So they were very aggressive, lobbying the Bush administration, for example. In the early days, you might not remember, George Bush actually pledged to regulate carbon dioxide and do something about global warming.
As a pollutant. This was
exactly.
In the 2000 campaign.
No one really remembers that because he never did anything. And he switched his campaign pledge because what happened is Bracewell and Patterson, which was funded basically by all these oil companies and these coal-burning power plants like Southern Company down in Atlanta, went and they hired Haley Barbour, now the governor of Mississippi, who was one of the most powerful Republican lobbyists in Washington, and they lobbied Dick Cheney, and they lobbied his secret energy task force, and they basically got the Bush administration to say, okay, fine, we're not going to do anything about CO2, forget Kyoto, forget it all, we'll just argue about the science of this matter for 7 years. And then they, in turn, did a bunch of other stuff. They exempted coal-burning power plants from lawsuits that the Clinton administration had filed to try to get them to clean up. They did all sorts of different things. And what happened was, in 2005, Giuliani, by then, in 2005, had a very robust financial empire he'd set up. You may remember his consulting firm, Giuliani Partners, made a lot of money after 9/11 doing a variety of businesses, but he wanted a law firm. Rudy, after all, was a lawyer, worked in the Reagan Justice Department, was the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, which included Manhattan, and basically, the law firm that Rudy chose was Bracewell and Patterson, which then became Bracewell and Giuliani. And it was an interesting decision because basically by the time that Rudy had joined it, this reputation of the place as being the home of the energy industry in D.C. And being a place in Texas that represented all these firms was very well known. So Rudy clearly knew what he was getting into. And what I report in the piece is that basically – this was as much a political as a legal venture. I mean, he made a lot of money from it, first off, but it also
gave him... They paid him $10 million from their firm to his firm, plus
$1 million
a year
in compensation. Services, plus revenue of the New York office that he opened for them, which now is becoming larger and larger and getting more and more clients. And Giuliani actually brought over a number of top lawyers from the city of New York, including the son, Mark Mukasey, of the attorney general designate. So clearly the ties run deep, and basically what Rudy was hoping for is to build all these inroads in Texas, basically get all this Texas energy money that was up for grabs in the Bush years. And since no one has laid claim to it, Rudy sort of swept it and got all these Bush pioneers and all these people that you wouldn't think normally would be in the Giuliani camp, but now he has all these ties down in Texas that he wouldn't have had otherwise, I think, without this law firm.
Right. And in fact, he has more than anybody else, more than John McCain was number two in picking up Bush's former bundlers. You talk about Mr. Oxford, Pat Oxford. He was a managing partner of Bracewell and Patterson. So, again, here's this law firm, Bracewell and Patterson. They sent a letter or they contacted Dick Cheney very early on and said, don't make carbon dioxide a pollutant. The Bush administration changed their tune. They've been singing that song for a long time. And Pat Oxford knew Karl Rove. He described himself as a fast friend. He was a member of the Mighty Texas Strike Force, which traveled all around the country in the 2004 election. In 2000, this guy bragged that he ran Broward County. In 2004, his strike force in Ohio was a big deal. Tell us about that. This is the guy who is Rudy Giuliani's business partner.
Yeah, I mean, he's a managing director of Bracewell and Giuliani. He's the guy down in Houston who basically set this whole deal up. What happened is that a man who Giuliani had tasked with basically setting up his consulting firm, Giuliani Partners, his name is Roy Bailey. He's from Dallas. He met Pat Oxford at the 2004 Republican convention and said, what do you think about Rudy basically becoming part of this firm? And Oxford said, absolutely, let's do it. So then Rudy joined Bracewell. They changed the name to Bracewell and Giuliani. And Oxford and Rudy have been very close buds ever since. Oxford's very politically plugged in Texas, so he squired Rudy all throughout the state. And as you mentioned, there's been a bit of contention about this task force he set up, which sent volunteers down in Texas into these swing states. And in 2004, according to a report by the Democratic staff on the Judiciary Committee, basically what they were doing is they were calling up people using payphones, targeting people that had recently been in the prison system and saying, if you vote, you'll go back to jail and the FBI will find you, which clearly wasn't true and clearly was illegal. And it was alleged that Oxford's operation was part of that. So it was sort of a moment of infamy for him. But this is a guy who's been close to Bush, close to Rove, fancies himself a businessman, but also a Republican operative in the state, as someone who can raise a lot of money for Giuliani and play a very big role in getting other people with a lot of money into his campaign.
There's even an involvement with Swift Boat veterans.
Well, yeah, I mean, one of Rudy's largest supporters down there is this major oil man named Boone Pickens, who made a fortune as a corporate raider on Wall Street.
The T. Boone Pickens?
T. Boone Pickens. Yeah. And has since, you know, made just an absolute bundle running this hedge fund that specializes in energy investments, now has bought all this water, basically it's privatized water that he's going to plan to sell for a huge amount of money. Down in Texas, they consider water the new gold.
Just in Texas, by the way.
Or the new oil, we should say. Yeah, absolutely. So Pickens basically was one of the guys who put up all the seed money for the Swift boats. When they needed $500,000, he kicked it in. He ended up giving something like $2 million to the group. The only other person who gave as much was Bob Perry, who's another Texan who's actually with Mitt Romney. He's one of the big guys that Rudy didn't
give. And then there's Bob McNair in this equation as well.
Yeah, Bob McNair, who owns the Houston Texans, Houston Texans also put up a lot of money. I think McNair is still uncommitted, to the best of my knowledge, in terms of who he's backing. But Rudy recently was at a Texans game with McNair and Oxford, et cetera. And then right before that, he was at a Texas Rangers game, because another one of his major supporters is this guy named Tom Hicks, who bought the Texas Rangers from Bush in a very lucrative deal, and then went on to be the vice president of Clear Channel at the time when that mega station.
Yeah, I was going to say that name sounds familiar, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. The mega millionaire behind Clear Channel, who you remember was banning songs after 9/11 and sponsoring pro-war rallies all over the place and basically acting as a megaphone for the Bush administration. And Hicks actually declared on a conference call with Clear Channel employees in 2000 that it was going to be the policy of the company to support George W. Bush, and that lawyers from Clear Channel would be in touch with upper management about how best to do that, which is a pretty brazen thing to do.
That's interesting. That let me just, by the way, just toss this in. I do a morning show here on AM 620 KPOJ, which is where this show is originating from, which is owned by Clear Channel. So for 2 years, I've drawn a paycheck from Clear Channel and done a morning show for them. They have never, ever, nobody from Clear Channel has ever tried to influence what I say on the radio. Their message to me has been, make us money, say anything you want.
Well, that's good. And
maybe there's been a big change since 2004.
Hicks is out of Clear Channel, I should say. He actually sold it to this private equity group. Ironically, one of the buyers was Bain Capital, where Mitt Romney used to work.
Yeah. I should say, by the way, the same thing about Air America. I also work for Air America, which is the show that you're on right here. And similarly, nobody from management at Air America has ever said, say or don't say this or that, or have this person on as a guest or whatever.
They don't tell you to play pro-war songs in America.
You know, they don't. They both companies have been very agnostic. You know, and I respect that. I mean, you know. So anyway, so the bottom line here is that Rudy is in dirty money up to his eyeballs,
and he's an unlikely heir to George W. Bush. And it's not a coincidence that all this stuff is happening.
Yeah, and you can read all about it at thenation.com, or pick up a copy of The Nation, or all the better, subscribe to The Nation, readthenation.com. All right, Berman. The article, Rudy's Dirty Money. Ari, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news. This is Air America Radio.
Well, I think that's Rudy Giuliani's official campaign song. This is, especially after what we just heard. Oh, man, that is grim. Arlene Holt Baker is with us, the newly appointed executive vice president of the AFL-CIO, our labor segment this week. Arlene, welcome to the program.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome, or should I call you Vice President Baker?
Oh, just call me Arlene.
Okay, that's sweet. AFLCIO.org, by the way, the website for the AFL. CIO, as I guess most people can intuit, but nonetheless it bears repeating. You folks are doing some great work down in the Gulf Coast region. Tell us about this, Arlene.
Well, what we've done, Tom, we announced about 6 months after Hurricane Katrina our intent to invest nearly $1 billion in the recovery effort there, and our efforts would go toward helping rebuilding the Gulf with not only commercial but most importantly homes, affordable homes. So we are very excited to be able to announce today, it's been some press on this, that we're moving in the right direction there.
Now, how does a union do that? I mean, I can see where, you know, a company that builds homes would come along and say, you know, we're going to do something in the Gulf Coast or you know, Habitat for Humanity. But how does a union do that?
Well, we're able to do it because we have, you know, with our pension investments and our pension funds, to be able to use those. Of course, keeping always our fiduciary responsibilities, having that being the priority.
Sure.
But our having those funds and looking for good investments, and what better way to invest than to invest in building homes for not only our union members but the broader community. As I was about to say, we have invested in a manufactured housing plant there, Housing International, and Housing International will be producing steel frames for homes, and we're very excited about the fact that this plant is a unionized plant that, when it's at its peak, will have up to 200 unionized workers in it. And maybe for us, one of the more exciting points here is not only will they be unionized workers, but these are workers that are being trained now through our Building Trades Pilot Project Program, and these workers come from the community. So this means an investment in a plant, an investment in people and training, and the ultimate product being steel framing for a home, an affordable home.
That's extraordinary. I've often noticed that as much as I opposed the invasion of Iraq, we did have a successful invasion. I mean, we knocked down their government. The occupation has been totally screwed up because instead of, like with the Marshall Plan after World War II, giving money to the Iraqis and saying, okay, start your cement factories, start your construction companies, rebuild your country, here's some cash to help out, we brought in our own companies. We brought in Halliburton and Bechtel and whatnot. And we did the exact same thing down in New Orleans. We did, you know, it was not local companies that were tasked with putting New Orleans back together. You know, here's Bechtel and Halliburton and Blackwater. It's so bizarre.
You know, Tom, not only that, we bought in companies who have a track record of they're not companies that support the unionization of their employees, but companies that, as we've known, have violated a lot of the labor laws, and in a number of cases, they subcontracted to subcontractors who subcontracted again,
right,
for the product. So, and workers at the end of the day, yes, they got the billions of dollars with their no-bid contracts, but once again, who's been hurt by it? It's been workers who were not paid their fair wages and exploited in many ways, and unfortunately, a number of immigrant workers who've been exploited.
Yeah, and the local community as well.
Absolutely.
The money should have ended up, and it didn't. It ended up in the pockets of Stephen Bechtel in California or the guys down in Halliburton down in Texas. We're talking with Arlene Holt Baker, the newly appointed executive vice president of the AFL-CIO, AFLCIO.org. You're doing a lot of work on health care, Arlene.
Well, somebody's got to do something. You got 47 million Americans that don't have health care, and every one of us in this country can relate. I often ask people when I'm talking to groups or individuals, do you know anyone that doesn't have health care in your family or on your block? And the unfortunate answer is, I certainly know someone because they're in my family.
Mm-hmm.
So with that crisis that we have, the AFL-CIO, we are engaged in a campaign, a health care campaign, certainly with elements that talk about controlling costs, We know cost is going to have to be controlled, because each time we go to the bargaining table now, that is one of the biggest issues at the table for us, is the rising cost of health care. And then we also are very concerned about, you know, the affordability for others. And then, of course, it's got to have a piece of it that talks about preventive care that needs to be provided by health care providers. So it is major. It is major because it is impacting every segment of our society, whether you're unionized or without a union.
Yeah, well, that's a marvelous thing, and I congratulate you, and I salute the AFL-CIO, a union that my father used to be a member of. Or actually a union that was part of the AFL-CIO. In any case, Arlene Holt-Baker, the newly appointed executive, and two of my brothers, the newly appointed executive vice president of the AFL-CIO and AFL-CIO.org, the website. Arlene, thanks so much for dropping by and talking with us today.
Okay, thank you so much, Tom.
Great having you with us.
Okay.
27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
866-303-2270, our telephone number. Drop by our live chat room and say hi. Go to TomHartman.com and click live chat up at the top of the page. There's all kinds of other cool stuff there. And, of course, at AirAmerica.com, you'll find our blog and lots of cool stuff there as well. Or great stuff, or whatever the word of the day is. 1-866-303-2270, Mike in Portland, Oregon, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. You know, I've been a Democrat for a long, long time, but I might be a little, I might have a little bit different tack on Hillary than most of the guys that have been calling. First of all, I think Joe Biden would be the best choice, but it doesn't look like he's going to be able to pull it off. But
he'd make a hell of a Secretary of State, you know.
Pardon me?
He'd make a great Secretary of State.
Yeah, I think he'd make a great Secretary of State, and I think Wesley Clark would make a great Secretary of Defense.
Yeah.
But one of the things I like about Hillary is, I've heard this before, it would be a twofer. I mean, Bill Clinton is not going to keep his hands out of it. And to have them both back in a position where they can actually make some change, I think that we'd be in good shape.
I think, Mike, that there is a small subset, and I don't know if by small I mean 5% or 40%, but there is a subset of the Democratic populace that is voting for Hillary Clinton. And again, as I've said, I'm not anti-Hillary. If she's the nominee, I will support her. I just, you know, she's not my first choice in the primary.
Yeah.
But there's a small subset of people who are pretty upfront in saying that the main reason that they're supporting her is because they want Bill back in the White House, even if he's just, you know, walking the halls and offering suggestions and things.
You know, another thing about Bill is that he prosecuted the war, at least was a part of the war in Bosnia, and handled our role in such a way that it was minimum casualties to us. And
not a single U.S. soldier died.
Yeah, and, you know, he disproved the old idea that air power can't win a war. I mean, all we did is just basically strategically bomb certain areas
Although that also, Mike, is a war not without its controversy. I mean, there are some who suggest that by doing it that way, he might have minimized American casualties, but he maximized or increased somewhat the casualties of civilians. I mean, I every time I bring this up, it's just amazing to me the number of emails I get from people saying, yes, it was a great thing what he did. No, it was a horrible thing that he did. And, you know, supporting it with details and facts and things. As I've said on the show many times, I was not there, and I at that particular moment in time, I was doing international relief work, and I wasn't paying that much attention to what Bill Clinton was doing and what was going on in Bosnia. So I was out of that loop. I was out of the U.S. loop, in fact, at that time. But in any case,
no,
it's but your point about Hillary that you So what's the bottom line here, Mike, for this
call? Well, this is, and you actually segued into to what I really wanted to talk about. You know, I think, you know, as in the Clinton campaign, the original one, it's the economy, stupid. Well, I think this whole campaign is going to be about the war. And this is where I differ from most Democrats, and I do agree. I don't know why Hillary is so motivated, but to continue to want to keep this war going. But I think an abrupt pullout from Iraq, is we were the ones that caused this problem. And to pull out of Iraq, in my opinion, would set up another killing fields over there.
Yeah, well, see, that's the debate. I mean, you know, it's what's going to happen if we pull out. There are many of us, and I include myself in that number, who believe that we are the primary irritant there, and that and if you look at those parts of Iraq right now that are relatively stable, they're places where we pretty much don't have a presence. And, you know, it may not be a wonderful egalitarian democracy in those regions. They revert typically back to tribal, you know, rule, but it's tribal rule that's been working for them for thousands of years. And so I respectfully disagree with you, but I get your point, and I gotta move along. I got a whole bunch of calls here, Mike, but thank you for calling. Sarge in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Sarge, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I want to thank you for that lady that from the AFL. LCIO.
Arlene Hall Baker.
As a Katrina survivor, someone that spends a lot of time on Katrina issues and at unreportednews.net, it's important that people realize the people in the Katrina area are still suffering dramatically, in many ways worse than the day after the storm. Yep. There's a lot of things going on wrong. If they go to my website, they can read about all the different things because I do cover the area. And I just want to thank you, Tom, for putting that on because people need to go down there. They need to help. They need the support down there because the government is really just turning it into a miserable failure.
You're right, and you're welcome, Sergeant. Your website is?
Unreportednews.net, and also I have a Sunday morning radio show on KPHX that they can stream off of the site. So, Tom, thank you, my friend.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot for calling in, Sergeant, for the good work that you're doing. Tom in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, WPTT.
Hello, Tom. Hey, Tom. How are you today?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Not much. As always, enjoying the show. However, I was listening to your response to Anthony from Seattle earlier, and I have to say
if I may interrupt you just for a moment. We've gotten a couple of emails from people saying that the gig in Seattle tonight is not a fundraiser for Hillary. It's a fundraiser for the Democratic Party. She just happens to be the keynote speaker. And the caller, I guess, left the impression, I certainly got the impression, that it was a Hillary event. Apparently it's not. It's a
yeah,
party
I got that,
event.
Yeah, I got that impression.
And
as well.
So just to set the record straight, supporting the party is a good thing.
Okay. I just wanted to say I disagreed with the tenor of your response to him. It seemed you were saying that what you must do is come out and to avoid creating the artifact of a circular firing squad within the Democratic Party, say nothing bad about Hillary Clinton, be only positive, and simply state, once again, giving very affirmative tone to their impression of Hillary Clinton, that maybe they'd like a certain vote from her, or maybe they'd like a certain...
What I was saying, and let me be very, very unambiguous here, Tom, was attack the policy, not the person. Or promote the policy, you know, not the person.
I didn't get the impression that he was engaging in ad hominems so much as he was simply saying, en toto, they do not find Hillary Clinton to be acceptable, which is something that... myself and many of my my personal acquaintances share in
well, I think, you know, progressives hate Hillary or reject Hillary or whatever the
well, I would agree with
verb
that.
Was in there.
Reject her, absolutely. And I think it's actually incumbent upon them as a duty to themselves, to the party, to the country, to come out and state forthrightly, I mean, no uncertain terms, we reject this candidate as a nominee.
But there has to be an and there.
Yes.
It's not just enough to say we reject that. Otherwise, what you're doing is you're playing right into the Republicans' hands of, oh, you got a bunch of disaffected voters. They're simply not going to show up. You have to say, you know, yes, I reject this and I hold this. Or I reject this person in the context of this policy. And if he or she changes this policy, I may support them.
I would agree that by providing the second prong of their argument, saying, and we advocate this, giving the sense of advocacy to their views in an affirmative manner, would make it possibly more fully articulated and better, a more constructive way to approach it. But the idea that...
Well, now you're agreeing with me, Tom.
not to voice in no uncertain terms, we reject this candidate. We do not want this candidate. We will not have this candidate. Our feelings are this strong and this pointed. I think it's very important not to blunt that, not to mute that, not
but
to
see,
attenuate that.
You know, he says he's speaking for all progressives. I would put my progressive credentials up against anybody. I mean, I've been writing on these topics for 15 years. I've been involved in progressive politics since SDS in 1968. Right. And I don't reject Hillary. I just don't put her as my first choice. And I think that there's a huge difference between saying that you reject somebody and
right.
saying, you know, this is not my preference, but if this is my only choice, then I'm going to do everything I can to A, get that person elected, and B, influence that person's policies.
Of course there is. And that's the difference that they need to stress, is that they don't agree with you, Tom. It's not that they find her okay, but, you know, really not to a very strong extent or to a great extent. And they'd prefer something else. No, they want to make the statement, we do not find this candidate acceptable, which is the statement that I would want to make.
Yeah. Well, I get it. Tom, I got to move along. But, I get it. You said it well. I think we're getting into a bit of a gray area here. I'm not sure. Stephen in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Stephen.
Hello, Tom. Boy, I'm glad you took me next, because I really got to respond to the last caller. I wish you would have asked him, if he rejects Hillary Clinton and she does become the nominee, which is not at all sure, but it's very likely, what is he going to do? Hope to bring her down and elect Giuliani or Romney president?
That's the problem. By attacking candidates, we're actually, this is anytime somebody has a primary that's contested,
yeah.
in a congressional race, it wounds them and it makes it harder for them to run against an incumbent or a challenger who doesn't have a contested primary.
Listen, Tom, I've heard other, not on your show necessarily, but I've heard even other, I'm not going to even mention who, but a well-known progressive liberal talk show host at night and his callers say that they're actually wanting to bring Hillary down, even if it means getting a President Giuliani or Romney. That is crazy.
Yeah.
And when they say that Hillary is a neocon or a right winger, I mean, my God, do you think President Hillary Clinton would veto that CHIPS program? Do you think that Hillary Clinton would they rather have her appoint Supreme Court justice or a Romney or a Giuliani or
no, I absolutely right, Stephen. And the point that I keep making and that we have to keep remembering is that Teddy Roosevelt, who is arguably one of the most progressive presidents in the history of the United States, ran as the rich white guy representing corporate America when he was the vice president to McKinley. And Franklin Roosevelt in 1932 ran on a platform that had to do with micromanaging tariffs. I mean, it was as moderate as you could get. And yet these people, when they got into power and they heard what the people had to say, they transformed this country in a very positive and meaningful way. So I have not given up hope for anybody on the Democratic side anymore. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Stinking oil. We certainly don't need to be sending billions of dollars a week to Saudi Arabia. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. TomHartman.com, AirAmerica.com, 866-303-2270. Ron in Burlington, Vermont. Hey, Ron, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. You're missing the leaf peeping here in Vermont. Wish I had you back here.
Oh, and I miss it. You know, we lived there 10 years, and this is absolutely my favorite season in Vermont.
Oh, yeah.
It's so nice.
Gorgeous. Hey, the person who wrote that book, Fooled Again, I'm curious.
Mark Crispin Miller.
Did he get the title from the music of The Who?
I don't know.
I don't know.
He may well
boss,
have. You know,
as the old boss?
Yeah, Mark is certainly old enough to remember The Who. Mark is a friend. He, in fact, at the top of our website, there's a link to a rap that I gave about my book Screwed at Vox Pop, the bookstore in New York. And Mark Crispin Miller introduced me, and then we did question and answer afterward and wrapped it up. And Mark is the author of Fooled Again, about the theft of the elections of 2000 and 2004 and the various in-between ones, too, 2002 to 2006.
On a serious note, do you think... I got a problem with this whole definition thing, and I think
there's a new generation, you know, our youth, that is getting inundated by these talking heads, and they no longer know the true definition of things. You know, a doctor friend of mine said, you know, we discovered new medical discovery techniques and things, but unfortunately, they don't come into practice until the established doctors die off.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of think it's the same thing where you had this guest on talking about Islamic fascists.
Mm-hmm.
And fascism really doesn't have anything. Correct me if I'm wrong, but fascism wasn't about killing Jews during World War II.
No, that was Hitler being a homicidal maniac. The real fascists were Franco in Spain and Mussolini in Italy, and Hitler arguably in his early days. But fascism is the merger of corporate and state enterprises in an authoritarian regime.
Yeah, I'm with you. But these talking heads make it sound like, oh, here's the enemy because they torture, they do this to people. It's an economic.
Well, that's why I said, you know, I agree with you, Ron. These guys, they're totally twisting things around. David Horowitz was the guy who was on the show last Friday. And he's got this Islamo-fascism week, you know, where he's got Ann Coulter.
Crazy,
he's got Ann Coulter and Rick, what's his name, the former senator of Santorum, the former senator from Pennsylvania, you know, who doesn't think that women should have birth control and who brought home a miscarriage in a bottle to show his children. I mean, this guy is bizarre. And his own wife's miscarriage. And he's got these guys traveling around college campuses, and that's why I said, let's make this fascism.